Companies are slowly going extinct, but they seem to be doing it in the worst way possible. A report by Harvard found that between the mid-1990s and the mid-2020s, the number of listed corporations halved at the same time that their profits doubled, creating less competition and an overall much larger market. At the same time, 2025 just capped off a year with the highest levels of major corporate bankruptcies since the global financial crisis. And it only did this after beating out 2024, which also had the highest level of corporate bankruptcies since the GFC. Even amongst the largest companies on Earth, turnover has never been higher outside of a major market downturn. For most of the 20th century, companies spent on average of 30 years in the S&P 500 once they made it into that club. Today, it's down to just 14 years. Now, all of this isn't necessarily a bad thing. Technology, tastes, consumer, and investor preferences all change, and good companies should not necessarily be trying to last forever. What's more is that the rate of new business formation is also at a record high, which sounds great. But if you are able to look into the data, you will unfortunately see that this increased business churn rate isn't going to help new business owners. It won't help consumers. It certainly won't help workers. And ironically enough, it won't even help existing shareholders either.
99 cents only stores are shutting down.
Red Lobster is officially underwater.
One of the country's largest pharmacy chains, Rite Aid, has filed for bankruptcy protection.
Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun has announced he will no longer be CEO of Boeing. He will end that role at the company.
Gymshark has come a long way since its founder, Ben Francis, started making pieces of fitness wear in his parents' garage nearly a decade ago.
2017, when she had just reached unicorn status at the age of 30. But now, at the end of last year, she secured some new funding, which has taken the company to a valuation of $3.2 billion.
So if you want to make f*** you money by starting a disruptive tech company, you really only need to come up with an idea that ticks three boxes. The first step is finding an industry or even an everyday activity that is highly inefficient. People will gladly pay to make things easier for themselves. And in an economy where people are working multiple jobs, don't have stay-at-home partners for domestic chores, and are spending hours commuting every week, providing a product that saves a bit of time and energy is great, and people will pay for it. Now, finding a problem and then providing a marketable product to solve it is just business 101. But the problem for you is, it's kind of hard. Smart people are trying to figure this stuff out all the time. And maybe you will get lucky and think of something nobody else has. But there is an easier way. Find an industry that is inefficient because of man-made inefficiencies, or as the lawyers would call them, regulation. Step two is to figure out how to fix this problem with some kind of marketable technology. Now, this technology could be something revolutionary like the telephone, which fixed the issue of slow and inefficient communication through telegrams or postal mail. Or it could be something like Tinder, which solved the issue of slow, inefficient boinking through actually having to go out and talk to people. Technology can really mean anything. But if making money is all you're interested in, then it's a lot easier for that technology to be software that works on existing devices. Software is ideal because distribution and manufacturing are as simple as an Amazon Web Services subscription and a good copy-paste button. Once a program is developed, the variable cost for every additional user is basically negligible. Investors love this, so they will pay you and your business a lot more than they would any other business making real products. According to data collected by NYU Stern, software companies had the highest enterprise value to sales ratio of any business type. The only investments that had higher ratios were real estate investment trusts, but their value comes mostly from the real estate holdings and not their sales. So this is not really a fair comparison. The average company was valued by investors at between 6 and 10 times their total sales, which was especially impressive considering that some of these companies had negative operating margins, meaning that even though they were selling a product with almost zero marginal cost, they were still losing money. So by combining the easiest technology to develop with the easiest problems to solve, you will find that the perfect business to scale rapidly towards a life-changing exit is one that skirts regulation with software. Sounds dumb, but some of the fastest growing companies in history were founded on exactly this principle. Uber skirted taxi licensing and regulation by creating software that technically let people carpool together. If people happened to just turn their personal vehicles into full-time taxi services, that was just users not engaging with the technology as intended. Airbnb avoided the intense regulations that hotels have to adhere by just creating software that technically let people find a temporary roommate. If people purchased multiple specialty-built homes to run Airbnb hotel chains, that was just the user not engaging with the technology as intended. Cash App was just a way to settle small payments between friends. If it gets used as a shadow banking system for questionable activities, well, you get the idea. By the time these businesses get big enough for regulators to take notice of what's going on, they already have so many users that restricting them becomes very politically unpopular. Bill Gurley, a venture capitalist who invests in businesses like these, gave an admittedly fantastic presentation last year about how important these businesses are to avoid a phenomenon where big, inefficient incumbent businesses aren't challenged because regulations make it too hard for smaller, better businesses to enter their market. Clever loopholes like this are a great way to disrupt industries that are getting a little bit too comfortable and making a lot of money doing it. But before you get too excited, you should remember that sometimes regulations exist for a reason. So it's time to learn how money works to find out who the biggest winners and losers are in modern finance's dumbest game. This week's video is sponsored by HelloFresh. I was tired of wasting money on takeout every night, but planning meals and shopping for groceries always felt like too much hassle. HelloFresh changed that for me completely. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit, delivering over a billion meals for more than 9 million customers. What sets it apart is the huge selection, with over 100 recipes to choose from each week, way more than other services I've tried. The recipe takes 30 minutes or less, which is faster than waiting for delivery, and everything arrives right at my door, so I skip the stores entirely. No more forgetting ingredients or dealing with checkout lines. I love how it saves me time and money compared to my old habits of random grocery runs and expensive deliveries. Plus, with over 35 more high-protein options weekly, it keeps me full and helps me eat healthier without the effort. We've been using it to make quick, delicious meals like the Szechuan pork and green bean stir-fry, which was amazing. It's flexible too. I can pause or skip weeks anytime, no pressure. The recent improvements, like even more recipe variety and easier customization, have made cooking with HelloFresh more enjoyable than ever for me. Get a free Zwilling 4-star chef's knife on your third box, plus 10 free meals, and your first box ships free with code MONEYWORKS, HFZWL. Make sure to use my code to get this deal before supplies run out. Offer valid while supplies last. The link will automatically opt you into HelloFresh's best active offer if redeeming after the activation window. It's been half a year now since the collapse of Yada Bank, a bank for people who are fed up with banks. The disruptive new platform allowed depositors to participate in lotteries with their savings instead of receiving a typical and predictable interest rate. Most months, people would receive no payments, but there were winnings paid out to randomly selected people with entries based on how much cash they held in their accounts. People with more money got more entries and therefore more chances to win a significant prize. The average return on these winnings across all users was supposed to be roughly the same as the yield on a high-interest savings account. It was a novel idea that was arguably just a bit of fun for people trying to save some money. But banking and financial services are kind of hard. It's much easier to make money by running a casino, which is what Yada Bank slowly turned into, with other games that people could play with their savings. Now, you probably already know this, but this wasn't actually the worst part of this sketchy new way to save your money. The actual mechanics of running a bank, like processing transfers and, you know, keeping track of how much money people had on their accounts, was kind of hard. So it used a middleman which provided services to other fintech platforms on behalf of a real bank that had to adhere to all these boring old regulations. Synapse was a banking-as-a-service provider which was supposed to keep track of transactions for other platforms like crypto brokerages, online sports books, and stock trading platforms. So if you wouldn't feel comfortable keeping your life savings in DraftKings, you probably shouldn't keep your life savings in a bank that's not directly FDIC compliant. Somewhere in this chain, these companies couldn't agree on how much people had in their accounts, and so far, it has been average consumers that haven't been able to access their money. Simply losing track of how much people have is also outside of the domain of the FDIC, which only handles bank failures. So there are thousands of customers who simply had their money Thanos snapped into the banking ether. My friend Patrick Boyle did a great deep dive into the real financial mechanics of this clusterfuck. And of course, the suspender-wearing superhero CoffeeZilla covered the story as it was unfolding. Now the whole people losing their life savings thing here isn't really the point. The bigger issue here is that fintech has become one of the most popular industries for new startups to carve out market share in. Yada is just one example of where that has the potential to do a lot of harm to regular people. There is an old saying that every warning label on a piece of equipment is a gravestone for an appendage that was lost somewhere down the line. The amount of regulations that financial companies, let alone actual banks, are subject to is beyond the capabilities of any single human to fully understand. Endless red tape in services that we all use every day can be immensely frustrating, especially when it speeds up the consolidation of bigger and bigger banks. But Every law, every regulation, and every guideline that financial firms need to adhere to was written because something has gone horribly wrong in the past. The rush of new fintech companies skirting these regulations by falling just outside the bounds of a typically regulated body will end up with a lot more people losing a lot more money. By now, pay later services like Klarna, Affirm, Afterpay, and PayPal's built-in split payment function now handle billions of dollars in consumer transactions every year, and have become a massively popular alternative to traditional credit cards. When mixed with traditional consumer credit, these new services have accelerated reckless spending, with a lot of people using Afterpay to pay off their credit card and their credit card to make their Afterpay payments. This practice might sound silly to you or I, but for a lot of people, it's just an option of last resort when there is too much month at the end of their money. It's so common, in fact, that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a term for it, loan stacking. And it's something that is much more difficult with traditional debt products. Another problem with these new financial tools is how they make their money, if they bother to do that at all. These companies don't charge interest like typical personal loans or credit cards, and most of them don't have fees to open or maintain. So if you use them to make the scheduled payments without using it to justify any additional purchases, you might fool yourself into thinking that it's just a practical financial tool. But the business case for these companies is that you don't need to pay for the product because you are the product. They make their money by charging retailers a commission on purchases. These fees have so far been similar to the merchant fees charged by credit card companies, but some analysts argue that they have only been able to maintain these low fees because they are burning investor money to maintain market share. And when that money runs out, these hidden fees will all need to increase. Either way, the retailers are willing to pay these additional fees to buy now, pay later companies because they can offer them additional customers. When these companies were first growing, they promoted their own platforms that would push consumers to retailers that accepted their payment, which was a good way for these businesses to get some free advertising. As they have become more popular with consumers, it has become hard for retailers not to accept buy now, pay later services because a lot of people simply can't afford to pay with anything else. In either case, you are the product. BNPL services are packaging you up and selling you as a ready-to-purchase customer for the low, low price of some merchant fees. Consumer credit card laws are starting to catch up with these companies, but for a long time, they were able to hide just how much debt struggling Americans were taking on. Oh, and they were also really lax about money laundering. Coming from a banking background, finance is the industry that I am most familiar with, but it's also simultaneously something that most people don't properly understand. And something that can absolutely fuck up your life if you just make a few silly mistakes. But this is not just affecting your finances. This is happening in plenty of other highly regulated industries as well, including healthcare, which has already had some disastrous consequences. Here is the biggest challenge though. Nobody likes red tape, bureaucracy, and big incumbent businesses. I mean, big banks and credit cards clearly suck. And so do hotels, taxis, medical tests, traditional therapy, traditional investments, and housing. So when a new company comes along talking about revolutionizing an outdated industry, it's kind of exciting. And in the current financial environment, more hype means more investor dollars. It's much more unpopular and much less profitable to remind people that sometimes the boring red tape exists for a reason. Now, this isn't helped at all by the fact that the alternative we are rooting for is a bunch of companies that have slowly become monopolies. Again, not all monopolies are necessarily illegal, and hot take alert, some of them can even be good for consumers. A company is allowed to have market dominance if their product is better than all their competitors, or if no competitors even bother trying to compete because one company has such a commanding lead. Google, for a long time, had the best search engine on the internet. That's a bit more questionable these days. But people choose to Google things because that would normally give them the best search results. That's not illegal, unless that company uses its market dominance to entrench its position and make it harder for others to compete. Today, there are lots of search engines that are just as good, if not better, than Google. What Google actually got in trouble for was paying companies like Apple billions of dollars every year to make their search engine the default on their mobile phones, which made it much harder for these alternative search engines to compete. Because, let's be honest with ourselves, who is changing the search engine default options on our phones? Obviously, I am not a lawyer, and while I did consult one while writing this brief outline, if you ever find yourself running a Fortune 500 company, you probably shouldn't use a YouTube video as a guide on how to enact anti-competitive measures. Now, the reason this otherwise standard antitrust lawsuit is such a big deal is because monopolies have become an epidemic in the modern corporate world for three simple reasons. The first reason is that there is simply more opportunity than ever to create a monopoly. The goods and services that we consume are far more varied today than they have ever been at any point, even in modern history. Four decades ago, there weren't any search engines to monopolize, and the world's biggest companies made far more basic products. Take US Steel and Nvidia. Both of these companies were the most valuable in the world at their respective peaks. Both of them made products primarily to service other businesses, and both of them were at the forefront of an industrial trend. US Steel was making, well, steel right as America was on a building spree, and Nvidia is making H100 GPUs right as the world is pumping AI into everything. The difference is that steel beams are an extremely basic product compared to cutting-edge proprietary microprocessors. According to company filings, Nvidia sold 150,000 of these chips to Microsoft alone and another 150,000 to Meta so that the companies could accelerate the rate in which the internet is turned into procedurally generated slop. Every single one of these GPUs sells for around $25,000 according to Barron's, but it only costs the company a few hundred dollars to manufacture. Nvidia can get away with charging these margins because it is a monopoly, and these companies have literally nowhere else to go. Nvidia owns the market for AI compute because it has developed CUDA, which is the industry standard for building machine learning models. Remember, dominating a market because you can undercut your competitors or force suppliers not to work with them is illegal, but monopolizing a market because your product is better is completely fair game. It's hard to make steel beams so good that any other steel beam is literally unusable by comparison, so after antitrust laws were introduced, it was much harder to maintain a monopoly with a basic product, but even more profitable to maintain one with advanced products. I only used it as an example because talking about Nvidia in a video makes the YouTube algorithm recommend this video about Nvidia to people who want confirmation that their Nvidia shares are going to make them rich. Apple creates a monopoly with its product ecosystem. Microsoft has an effective monopoly on operating systems outside of Apple products. Google has a monopoly on search engine and online video. Aramco has a monopoly on Saudi oil, and Meta has a monopoly on boomer memes. These are the companies that have made it to the promised land of market dominance. But there are also trillions of dollars being invested into companies that do nothing but take market share. Food delivery, ride-sharing, and even AI applications tend to lose a lot of money, and are only kept alive by constant investor funding rounds. The only way that these businesses make sense is if they outlast their competitors by achieving market share through a product that is often made more appealing than it really ought to be by selling it below cost. Companies like Lucid Motors, Uber, and OpenAI lose money on every new customer and user they gain, but their investors don't care as long as they are gaining market share. If those companies do become a monopoly, then they can fatten up their margins and join the trillion-dollar club with the other tech monopolies. Now, this all sounds pretty dystopian, but in some rare circumstances, it can actually be good for you as a regular person. For a while, you can enjoy incredibly cheap food delivery, which was partially paid for by some Silicon Valley venture capitalist. And the user experience of streaming movies was better when Netflix controlled the entire streaming market. Across the world, there are thousands of businesses being started with the sole intention of just being acquired by a larger, more established company, or more recently, a private equity firm. Tax structures have incentivized investors and entrepreneurs to seek an exit over building a sustainable business that provides them with non-capital gains income over the long term. According to the corporate law firm White & Case, global mergers and acquisitions volume has tripled over the last two decades alone. One of the best ways to build a monopoly is to just buy out every other competitor, which is exactly what has been happening. Just this week, the global food giant Mars agreed to purchase Kellanova, the makers of Pringles and other snack foods, for $36 billion. This is one of the largest corporate acquisitions ever in an industry that is already dominated by a small handful of companies. With food prices as high as they are, more corporate consolidation isn't going to help. But it's only getting more popular because of the second reason, which is that it's just becoming so easy. Big companies have a lot of cash, and they've been able to borrow even more at very low interest rates for a very long time. Even now, after recent rate hikes, interest on institutional borrowing is much cheaper than it was for most of American corporate history. This has made it really easy for companies to buy every company in their field, and it's made it possible to build businesses where the only way that the founders will ever make any money is by selling it to someone else. You are watching this video right now on YouTube, which was acquired by Google before it made any money. And today, it's the company's largest revenue center outside of search advertising. The growth of private equity has helped this as well by providing another exit opportunity to company owners. Private equity acquisitions are normally smaller in scale, but that doesn't mean that they can't create monopolies. A common business strategy employed by private equity is to roll up businesses. If you ever find yourself as a private equity manager, here is how you would do that. You would buy up lots of local businesses from their owners. Depending on the size of your fund, these will most likely be small and unglamorous businesses like plumbing companies, HVAC shops, or local mechanics. These businesses are actually great acquisition targets because they make a nice stable profit and the owners don't have as many options to sell as a bigger, better known company. Which means if they want to retire or step away from their business, you are one of the only people they can get money from. Your next step is to centralize operations like booking, accounting, marketing, and customer support into one office. This cuts down on costs, but it also means that your businesses aren't going to be competing with one another. No private equity fund is going to be able to buy all of the mechanic shops in America. But you don't need to. If you own all the shops in a local area, you still have a monopoly. It's just a local monopoly, and unless people want to drive 2 hours to get their car fixed, they are going to have to pay what you ask. This is actually even better than the big global monopolies, because you are way less likely to get in trouble with the FTC because you are too small to show up on their radar. Not that it really matters, because of the third reason why everything is a monopoly these days. So this probably won't come as a shock to you, but regulators like the FTC and their equivalents in other countries haven't been doing the best job of fighting back against monopolies. These organizations have two strategies that they are supposed to use. The first is by blocking mergers or acquisitions that it deems as creating a monopoly. Remember, a monopoly can only exist if market power is achieved through a better product. So, merging two or more companies together that would have too much market power is technically against the rules. The second strategy is by breaking up companies that get too big into smaller competing companies like what happened with AT&T and Standard Oil. The problem is that it hasn't really been doing either. In fact, the big famous corporate breakups of the 20th century have regressed and they are slowly merging back together again. Monopolies are the natural state of businesses, and unless the authorities do something to address it, even companies that were famously broken up will eventually return back to the monopolistic equilibrium. So rather than allowing corporate America to buy up every business under the sun, breaking them up and letting them sink or swim on their own merits should be something that governments take seriously. But for some of these corporations, bankruptcy is just another way to make even more money. Bankruptcies aren't what they used to be anymore. And now, instead of being a corporate equivalent of Game Over, it's just another business strategy, which is just one of four reasons why it's become so popular. Now, you all know I hate videos from supposed experts with wide open mouths peddling some doomer bullshit. But the other three reasons why bankruptcies are on the rise are honestly worrying, and they also show why business leaders just don't take it seriously anymore. The first reason that bankruptcies are booming is because of a new investing strategy that rewards taking on as much risk as possible. Private equity is a broad classification of investing that just means putting money into companies that are not publicly listed on any securities exchange. Venture capitalists who invest in early startups are a type of private equity. All of the deals you watch get made on Shark Tank are private equity deals. If you give your family members a few $1,000s to get their Etsy store going in exchange for a cut of half their future profits, you are technically a private equity investor. So make sure you slap that on your LinkedIn profile. The private equity where the real money is, though, is the buyout funds. These are firms that raise billions of dollars from college endowments, retirement funds, and wealthy investors to buy entire companies. Their investment strategy is that the smart people running these funds can use their business experience to make improvements in the companies they buy to cut down on costs and increase sales. Their real investment strategy, however, is, as the great Benjamin would say, getting absolutely jacked to the tits on debt that they don't have to take responsibility for. Here's how that works. Let's say you are a partner at a private equity firm that's just been given $1 billion to invest. You go out and find a company that has potential but needs your business skills to properly turn it around. Let's call it playing things are us. You use your $1 billion to buy the company, and as the new owner, you hire a new CEO who you trust to do exactly what you tell them to do. Their first job as CEO is to go out and get a loan from a bank or other investors for as much money as they possibly can on Play Things R Us behalf. If the company is making a profit and is valued at $1 billion, the company should be able to borrow about $700 million. Now, you can tell your CEO to do one of two things with that money.
The first option is to tell them to reinvest it into the business by advertising, open more locations, or building out online capacity.
Your second option is to get them to just take the $700 million and pay it out to you as the company owner. If you decided on the second option, you can then use that money to go and buy another company and repeat it all over again. This is called a leveraged buyout. Private equity investors try to make this sound more complicated than it is, so they can charge their investors big fees. But it's really the same as real estate investors using cash to refinance or buy another rental property, just with two small differences. The first difference is that instead of buying real estate, they are buying entire companies. And the second difference is that unlike a mortgage, if the money borrowed by Playing Things or Us can't be paid back, the private equity firm is not responsible for that debt. For you, as a private equity investor, this makes getting your appointed CEOs to take out as much debt as they possibly can a great investing strategy. If you can turn the businesses around, you can 4 or 5x your investment very quickly. And even if the businesses do end up getting crushed by their debt, you only lose 20 to 30% of your investors' money. Because this investment strategy could generate high returns while very effectively managing risk, thousands of household name companies have been bought up using leveraged buyouts while interest rates were low. Now, the rates on prime commercial debt have tripled. These companies that have been saddled with trillions of dollars worth of debt can no longer make their repayments. But even though that is going to hurt lenders and employees, for the private equity firms that created this situation, it's going to be an amazing profit opportunity because you'll never believe it. They can use these bankruptcies to make even more money. Most corporate bankruptcies in America and around the world are not happening to big companies that are household names. According to consolidated data from bankruptcy filings collected by Bloomberg, the biggest increase has come from small to medium enterprises closing down for good. Small businesses are always risky to operate, but the kind of companies that are actually going bankrupt might surprise you. The Small Business Association of America defines a small business as any company with revenue ranging from $1 million to over $40 million, and by employment, from 100 to over 1,500 employees. Some of the small businesses going bankrupt are actually very big, and according to the U.S. Census Bureau, these companies provide jobs to nearly half of all working Americans. According to the same data, big companies like Bed Bath & Beyond, Amazon, WeWork, and Walmart only employ 23% of Americans. Even though each bankruptcy of a small business is going to have less effect than the bankruptcy of a major company, they are collectively larger and more important. The only reason nobody seems more panicked about it is because of the second reason bankruptcies are booming. It's overdue. In 2021 and 2022, company bankruptcies fell to an all-time low, even though market conditions were incredibly challenging. Almost no companies were failing, no matter how terribly they were run, because government programs like the Paycheck Protection Loans and rock-bottom interest rates meant that it was easy for companies to stay open by borrowing to cover expenses. Without these conditions, these companies would have failed a long time ago, which is why you'll hear them called zombie companies. These loans need to be paid back, and they are coming with a much higher interest payment. Small business loans are typically given on adjustable rates, unlike fixed-rate mortgages, so a business's interest payment can change at any time to match market lending rates. Adjustable rates on mortgages are very common in other countries, so repayments are hurting people's budgets there as well. But in America, thanks to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we don't have to worry about that. For now. Our companies are not so lucky, though. According to investment rating agency Moody's, $1.87 trillion of corporate debt that is considered junk quality is expiring between 2024 and 2028. That signifies a 27% jump from the $1.47 trillion recorded in last year's study for 2023 to 2027. Moody's does not track Paycheck Protection Program loans, so this figure does not include the $953 billion in additional loans that were given to companies to cover wages. According to public records compiled by CBS, $757 billion of those loans were forgiven. The businesses may be off the hook for these repayments, but they can no longer rely on them either. Most of this junk debt is held by the small companies that a lot of you watching this video right now work for. As this debt comes due, more companies are being forced into bankruptcy because they do not have enough cash to make their payments. That's a serious problem for you, the employee. But the third reason that bankruptcies are booming is because for companies, bankruptcy isn't always the end. It can be a whole new beginning. The differences between personal bankruptcies and corporate bankruptcies causes one of the most infuriating situations in business. Major corporate CEOs and executives regularly get paid millions of dollars after running their companies into bankruptcy, getting paid ahead of the shareholders, creditors, and even employees they screwed over with their poor management. This is technically illegal, but it still happens all the time. To know how the f*** this could possibly happen, you need to know that not all bankruptcies are created equal. For companies, there are two types of bankruptcy that you should know about, Chapter 7 and Chapter 11, the convenience store duo, if you will. Chapter 7 bankruptcy is good old-fashioned Monopoly-style game-over bankruptcy. Operations stop, and the company's assets are liquidated to pay back stakeholders in order of priority. Who gets money first in America is determined by the U.S. Bankruptcy Code, and it goes in order from secure creditors, who are usually banks that give loans against secured things like property or equipment, priority creditors like clients who held money with the company on account or employees, then unsecured debt holders are paid. and if there's any money left over after that, it gets split up between shareholders. If there are two classes of shares like there are in companies such as Berkshire Hathaway and Meta, then money is given to non-voting preferred shareholders first. This payment order is often called a waterfall or liquidity overflow, because until the very top of the priority creditors are fully repaid, not a cent is given to the next person in line. But there's an exception to this, and that's the CEOs that got the company into the mess in the first place. Companies regularly pay their CEOs and top executives millions of dollars to guide the company through the liquidation process, because a lot more value can be obtained for stakeholders if senior management can keep things operational until they are sold. If you were the CEO of a pharmaceutical company and you drove your business into the ground, you can't just turn off the lights and leave the keys to the auctioneers. Things like medical research and labs are only worth anything to potential buyers if they can be properly handed over. But as a ruthless corporate tyrant, you're going to want to know what's in it for you. A company going bankrupt might not even be able to pay your salary, since you are second in line as an employee. But because you can help people get their money back, they might make you a deal. A one-time payment to stick around until everything is finished. If companies didn't do this, their CEOs would usually quit and start looking for a new job as soon as they could. The most infamous example of this was Enron, which was a huge corporate bankruptcy caused by the fraudulent actions of the executives that were going to be paid millions of dollars to see the company through the bankruptcy they caused. Following that, Congress passed legislation aimed at preventing companies from paying retention bonuses to executives. According to Robert Jackson, an associate professor at Columbia Law School at Columbia University, they left a loophole in the law, though. Executives can be paid performance-based incentives for doing a good job with the bankruptcy they caused, which is different enough from a retention bonus to technically be legal. This loophole is even more important for the other type of bankruptcy, which is Chapter 11. This type of bankruptcy gives the company a court-appointed administrator that works with the company executives to rearrange finances and operations to try and pay back as much of the debt as possible while maintaining the good parts of the business so that they can keep making money to pay back creditors. This is why, even though Vice is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, it's still making videos, because that's a revenue center for their business. Chapter 11s are booming because now is the perfect time to renegotiate debt, because lenders would rather have something than nothing, and the last thing they want is a panic. Businesses aren't interested in raising money at such high interest rates either, so even though corporate credit ratings will be hurt, it won't change their plans. The fourth reason that bankruptcies are booming is because companies have learned to contain their operations within layers upon layers of holding companies and trusts. But is it a good thing that we allow zombie companies that should have gone out of business years ago to carry on by using clever accounting loopholes and debt refinancing? Or should we let them just die? The oldest businesses in the world are not huge financial successes. They are mostly small, family-owned operations from Europe and Japan that have run continuously for hundreds of years, never expanding and never taking major risks. These are, by their very definition, businesses operating in very traditional industries like hospitality and construction. In fact, the oldest business in the world is Kongo Gumi. I apologize to my Japanese viewers for butchering the name. The business started in 578 by building temples and was passed down through a series of family and non-family successors until 2006, when it fell on hard times and was purchased by an engineering conglomerate, the Takamatsu Construction Group, a publicly traded company. Kongo Gumi still operates to this day, constructing custom projects like event halls and libraries, but it no longer does so as an independent entity. Rumors surrounding the acquisition of Kongo Gumi suggest that the engineering firm only purchased the company because of its long history and cultural significance, not because of its business fundamentals.
Why did you do that?
The sad story of Kongo Gumi demonstrates the first mistake investors make when they place too much emphasis on a company's longevity, the hot hand fallacy. The hot hand fallacy is a psychological predisposition that humans have to see patterns where they don't exist.
You are crazy. You are a crazy son of a b***h.
If a basketball player is sinking free throw after free throw without missing, then a person falling for the hot hand fallacy would expect that the shooter is guaranteed to make their next throw, when the reality is that the odds of them making the throw are completely unchanged by their past record.
This is a classic error.
The odds are affected by the player's skill and how far back they are standing, but their shot history is exactly that, history. Which reminds me that you should all go and subscribe to How History Works. The hot hand fallacy is the simultaneously the most ignored and the most recognized mistake that investors make. Most investments even come with a disclaimer specifically to warn people that past performance is not an indication of future results. A company that has been in business for 100 years is no less likely to go bankrupt than a similar company that has only been in business for 10 years, if all other business fundamentals are the same. Their history, just like the basketballer, means nothing. Older companies have some advantages over newer companies: brand awareness, an existing customer base, and established operations. But these walls can do just as much to box in a business as it can to defend it from competition. Investors should really assess a company's business on a case-by-case basis, and it's not good enough to assume that just because a business is 100 years old, that it will continue to operate for another 100 years. Even if continued operation was a sure thing, that doesn't always make it a great investment just by itself. All businesses follow the business life cycle. A business is founded, it struggles to gather its first few customers and investors. If it is able to do that, it grows rapidly before it plateaus out after accessing all of the potential customers it can. From there, it can either launch a new offering to get its business to grow again, or it can decline and eventually close down. The plateau period can, in theory, last forever. In the case of the world's oldest companies, most of them are of pretty modest size, and it had little pressure to grow because it didn't take on debt or outside investors who want to see consistent returns on their money. Meta, is at the pointy end of this cycle right now. They were founded and then grew to be the largest social media company in the world, but now they have simply run out of new people in the world to sign up to their platform, so their business has started to plateau.
Look, I think Facebook has realized, or Meta now, has realized that it doesn't control its destiny. It doesn't own its content because content creators are leaving it right now to go create content on TikTok and taking their fandoms with.
The Zuck wants his business to grow again instead of declining and beginning the process of becoming the next MySpace. Meta's new product offering is the Metaverse, which so far hasn't been a huge success to say the least. But investors can at least see that it's an attempt to stay on the right side of the business life cycle. What Zuck and other established business owners like him wait too long to find out, though, is that there is a benefit of a business dying with dignity, and sometimes it's not worth throwing good money after bad. Zuckerberg and managers like him that are helming companies that must innovate to survive can find themselves in a position where their best personal interests are different from the best interests of their shareholders. Zuckerberg wants to keep his role as the CEO of the world's largest repository of personal information, and investors just want to make the most money possible. If all of these investors were given a choice to put their money towards a new independent startup making cumbersome motion sickness generators and dystopian virtual worlds, most of them would choose not to. But because they are investors in Facebook, they are being forced to indirectly invest in this idea, because Zuckerberg has decided that this is the way the company is going. The alternative would be for Facebook to maintain its current operations and work on reducing costs to make the most money that they can out of the existing social network. This could maximize dividends to investors until the business shuts down or is acquired by another entity that wants its own social network. Zuckerberg's position is slightly unique because he owns controlling shares, which means even a majority of regular shareholders can't vote him out as the CEO. But the story of businesses desperately trying to reinvent themselves is by no means unique to Facebook. Good businesses can grow, deliver great returns, and then shut down in the most efficient way possible, so not to waste any money which can be used for starting other good businesses. My good friend Patrick Boyle made a video about a year ago where he spoke of a report by McKinsey & Company, a high-end corporate consulting firm, which found that most of the largest companies in America today were founded only a short time ago, like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and yes, even Facebook. If the S&P 500 index was only made up of companies that have been around for more than 60 years, then its performance would have been more than a third lower. This research suggests that not only are companies with long histories no better off than young companies, they are actually significantly worse, and there are two reasons why. Reason one is that old companies tend to acquire corporate baggage as they operate. A company like General Electric, which has been in business for 130 years, will have 130 years worth of outdated processes, agreements, and problems that were too difficult to ever get rid of. This accumulation can also extend a negative company history as what becomes acceptable changes over time. Bayer no longer sells heroin today, but many people only remember it for the time that it marketed that its new product would be a great way to deal with the flu. Think of any old company, and you could probably think of something from their past that they would rather the public forget about.
No, forget it.
This process doesn't need to take decades either. To pick on Facebook again, as the company has aged, it has gone from the trendy platform for college kids to the angry boomer convention. Bad history can go beyond just cultural taboos and cancel culture as well. Large companies inevitably become embroiled in scandals, fraud, and other risky behaviors that can be swept under the rug in the short term, but over a long enough time horizon, corporate managers run out of rug. Enron, WorldCom, Wirecard, and Lehman Brothers all started out as perfectly legitimate businesses and operated for decades as such. But over time, started needing to cover up their cover-ups until their entire operations came unraveled in massive explosions of corporate fraud and risky business practices. Businesses, like any fine-tuned machine, eventually wear out and it becomes more costly to keep them running than it does to just buy a new machine. The second reason that old businesses underperform new businesses is because they become bloated with staff and operations that are not focused on the company's primary industry. Old large companies spend more time managing themselves than they do improving their product or service offering. The billionaire investor Carl Icahn made most of his money finding businesses like this and stripping out the layers of redundant managers and special side projects to make struggling businesses profitable again. This gave Icahn a bad name as a corporate raider, because most of the time when he acquired a business, a wave of layoffs would swiftly follow. One example that Icahn spoke about publicly was that of ACF, American Car and Foundry, a 207-year-old business that built train cars and then rented them out to rail lines. A simple business, in theory.
Yes, again, in theory.
Icahn noticed that the stock in the company was selling for roughly the same as the amount of all the assets the company owned, which was puzzling to the investor because it meant that the operations were being valued by other investors at effectively $0. Upon buying up controlling interest in the company, Icahn had learned that the Manhattan head office of the company spent very little time on focusing on improving the operations of the railcar manufacturing or leasing operations. Instead, 12 floors of analysts and managers were working on overcomplicated financial systems that even Icahn, a veteran financial investor, could not understand. Icahn eventually met with a plant manager over drinks who told him that his factory would run more efficiently if the head office didn't exist at all, because he spent more time creating reports and projections to satisfy the managers in Manhattan than he did on actually running his plant. Icahn took the suggestion on board and laid off all 12 floors of the head office. ACF was an old business that would not have survived much longer if it weren't for the activist's intervention. It serves as a great example of how old companies are not automatically good companies. The final reason that good companies should not last forever is that endless scopes of operation can cloud investing decisions over reasonable timeframes. Only a tiny fraction of a percent of companies will last more than 100 years, and only a tiny fraction of a percent of companies will ever be worth more than $1 billion. A company like Kongo Gumi will have returned less to its shareholders in 1,400 years of operation than a company like Amazon will have delivered in less than 30. When you invest in a company, you should have a clear idea of how that investment will be returned to you. If you are investing in a company that is new, you will want to see a roadmap with a clear schedule for when you are going to make your money back and then some. After that, it doesn't even matter if the business sticks around because you have already covered your base and everything else is just gravy. Older companies are rarely held to the same scrutiny because it's easy to think that it will continue to be around forever. Maybe you can just pick up a few dividends and then just sell it on to another investor if you need the cash. It's a strategy that works well until it doesn't. Good investing is about diversification, because casting a wide net is really the only way to reliably ensure that you gain exposure to the next group of companies that will deliver outsized returns over the coming decades. The problem is that markets that used to be crowded with competition are thinning out. The biggest corporations are swallowing market share, and the companies that used to keep them honest are quietly disappearing. It seems like every pre-revenue, pre-idea, pre-clue startup that vaguely mentions artificial intelligence is getting billions of dollars thrown at them by cashed-up investors. And yet, there is a problem that you may not have noticed. There just aren't that many companies anymore. In 1996, the market hit an all-time record of 8,090 companies publicly listed on the various stock markets around America. Today, almost 30 years later, despite the economy being 3 times larger and the market handling about 7 times as much capital, there are fewer than half as many companies publicly available to buy shares in. There are a lot of theories about what is going on here. From private equity making Wall Street irrelevant, corporate consolidation, to the dwindling of savings of average investors. But there are some even bigger issues at play here. So, where the f*** did all the companies go? At the time this video was released, 34.1% of market capitalization of the S&P 500 was comprised of just 7 companies: Microsoft, Nvidia, Apple, Amazon, Meta, Alphabet, and Tesla. If you throw in Berkshire, Broadcom, and Walmart, then that is over half of the entire market in just 10 companies. According to data from Standard & Poor's, at the end of 2015, the top 10 companies only accounted for 16.2% of the market. So in less than a decade, the market concentration within the biggest companies has tripled. Even if there were more companies that the public could invest in, they would matter a whole lot less. This trend is bad for investors, bad for workers, bad for consumers, and strangely, it's actually even bad for the companies themselves. But I am getting ahead of myself. First, we need to know why this is happening. One of the big changes that most analysts are pointing to is the growing role of private equity. We have discussed the details of exactly what private equity is in a few videos, but if you are new here, all you need to know is that it's a firm that invests in companies or other assets that are not listed on public exchanges like the NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. According to the investment data firm Preqin, the amount of money that private equity firms are now managing in America alone is up 1,200% since the year 2000. So as this has grown, market share has been taken away from public exchanges. For a lot of companies, it's just not worth it to meet the compliance requirements of public listings because then early investors and management have to listen to thousands of stockholders instead of just one or two big private equity firms. Average investors also don't have that much money, and the average person owns most of their shares through managed retirement accounts anyway. Those retirement funds also invest in private equity firms, so going public doesn't really offer anything that can't be achieved by just selling to a private equity firm unless the company is absolutely massive. Even when private equity firms want to take profit on their investments, there is a growing trend of them just selling their assets to other, even bigger private equity firms. According to records from Apollo, one of the biggest private equity firms in the world, the number of companies financed by private equity increased by over 9,000 since the turn of the millennium. If these companies had to raise money the old-fashioned way through an IPO, then the number of public companies would be much more in line with the historical trend. So mystery solved, right? Wrong. There is one more story than just private equity ruining everything. Again, just having the same number of companies as there were 30 years ago wouldn't account for the fact that the economy is much larger overall. If the relationship between businesses and business activity held, there should be something like 25,000 public companies, but there are actually less than 4,000. Not only are companies getting more concentrated, but their ownership is getting more concentrated as well. The largest shareholders in almost every major company listed in America and most of the rest of the world today is some combination of BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. Now, you have probably seen the endless thumbnails about these companies being evil empires plotting world domination. And honestly, that's probably not true. The reality is that they manage assets on behalf of millions of individual investors. They don't actually own that themselves. The index investment products they offer are also really convenient for most investors who want diversified exposure to the market but are unable to buy and balance hundreds of shares individually because that would take an inordinate amount of time and money. But even though this reality is a little bit less exciting than an evil empire operating from the shadows, it doesn't mean that its growing popularity is any less damaging to your actual financial situation. And to see why, we are going to have to roleplay as Wendover Productions for a second. According to public 13G filings, the top shareholder of Delta, Southwest, United, and American Airlines is the Vanguard Group, which owns millions of shares in each company, primarily on behalf of their clients through its index products. Collectively, American, Delta, Southwest, and United control more than 70% of the market for air travel within America, according to the commercial aviation data firm AOG. Individually, the best way for these companies to grow their business would be to take market share from one of the other three by offering lower prices, better service, or more convenient routes. This is the basis of good, healthy competition. And in the bad old days, when shareholders would largely own one company they believed in, this is how it would work. But when their largest shareholders also own an equal stake in every other business in the market, they are a little bit less keen on crushing their opposition. If Delta pushed hard against United on all of their routes, then they might take market share from them. But for their shareholders, all they have done is cut into the profit margins to win a war against themselves. Instead, the growing pool of shareholders that own stakes in all of these companies equally are going to be financially better off if these companies grow their margins by extracting more from their customers through cost-cutting service, more fees, and confusing bookings. If you can believe that that would ever happen. Now, even this by itself isn't the whole story, because, spoiler alert, this little game isn't even good for the shareholders either. So it's time to learn how money works to find out why companies are going extinct. This video is sponsored by Vessi, aka the sneakers that have quietly taken over my daily routine. You know those everyday moments that don't make the highlight reel? Coffee walks, daycare drop-offs, Target runs? Vessi is made for all of it. Their weekend sneaker is the one I keep by the door. It's waterproof, lightweight, and honestly just easy. Slip them on and you're out the door in seconds. I've worn them in the rain, over wet sidewalks, and even through a few too close puddles. And, well, they're still dry and still comfy. Plus, they look good. Clean, minimal design that works whether I'm in joggers or jeans. They're comfortable enough to wear all day and durable enough to handle whatever the day throws at you. I've stopped checking the weather because it just doesn't matter anymore. Make every day a little easier. Visit Vessi.com/money now for 15% off your first pair at checkout and start exploring with confidence. Now, hot take alert. But if they are all well regulated and they are not in vital industries, sometimes monopolies can be good for consumers, at least for a little while. Netflix once had a near monopoly on content streaming, and for a few years, it was really good. The price was reasonable, and in return, you could get access to an extensive library of on-demand content without the challenges and risks that came with sailing the high seas. But seeing the opportunity, companies like Disney, Apple, Paramount, NBC Universal, Amazon, and Warner Brothers all introduced their own offerings to the market and started locking their own content with their own subscriptions. Today, to get access to a comprehensive library of content, you would need about 5 or 6 different subscriptions, easily costing more than the cable this was all supposed to replace. Even the studios arguably did better under the Netflix arrangement, because they could license their content for additional revenue instead of losing billions of dollars every year trying to take market share. Now, this is actually nothing new. As new technologies emerge, lots of businesses try to get into the market and naturally only a few survive. Even the very first international corporations, the Dutch, British, and French East India companies, were effectively just state-sanctioned monopolies because that was the only way they would work. The difference now is that instead of raising money and starting a new business from scratch to take advantage of a new marketable technology, existing businesses just use their own cash to do it in-house. Netflix is the only major player in the streaming market that wasn't already a film studio or major technology company before getting into streaming. And outside of digital media, the lesson is the same. Big is beautiful. A company like Amazon can offer same-day delivery and global cloud computing services because of its scale. Individual brick-and-mortar retailers could be content with operating out of a few select locations, but to compete directly with Amazon would require an investment of hundreds of billions of dollars into an immense network of warehouses and distribution centers. It's easier for most businesses to just give up and sell through Amazon instead. Legacy brands like Toys R Us or Bed Bath & Beyond just can't compete on price or convenience with their smaller scale and higher overhead. Social media, like the brands under Meta, only have value if everybody is using the same service, so users naturally gravitate towards the largest providers in any particular niche. If you want to shout about how hard it was back in your day under Minion memes, you go to Facebook. If you want to shout about how hard it is under the current day under Bernie memes, you go to Reddit. And if you want to shout about how hard it is to synergistically integrate the joint development interregional self-layoff project, you go to LinkedIn. Because that's where you will find fellow boomers, fellow comrades, and fellow corpo bots respectively. Now, I know you know that antitrust regulation is severely lacking here in America, and most of the rest of the world. But even if we are actually good at playing Monopoly Whack-A-Mole, they will naturally keep popping up. Companies themselves are less resistant to being acquired because a lot of their investors are the same people on both sides. And a single entity that isn't regulated should make better returns than two entities that have to, at least pretend to, compete. Businesses getting bigger is the natural process. Big businesses have more money to invest into more growth and more opportunities. And if these companies can't create something from scratch, they will just buy it from someone who can. So far, you have seen how the shifting role of private equity in broad market asset managers has accelerated this. But there is another group that's emerged that stops a lot of companies from even existing in the first place. Ironically, venture capital is a niche of private equity that focuses on funding hopeful startups rather than large existing businesses. In theory, lots of venture capital activity should encourage lots of new business development, but the industry has realized that's not the best way to maximize returns. The best way to make money is to instead scale a business really quickly in the hopes that the big tech companies will just acquire it. A paper published by the Journal of Information, Economics, and Policy found that this process systematically stifled genuine innovation because businesses were funded to be sold, not to actually provide value to the market. The problem is if these companies try to start a service that competes with one of these companies' existing services, venture capitalists don't want to touch it because it becomes far too risky. The existing company with huge cash reserves can compete with the fledgling startup until they have run out of cash and then go back to business as usual. This creates what The Economist affectionately branded kill zones, where startups find it really hard to find investors once they threaten the existing big businesses. The most laughably ironic thing about all of this is that yes, businesses with more market power are bad for consumers, who they have more price control over, and even worse for employees who may only have one or two companies where they can get a job with their skills. But the great business extinction hasn't even been good for investors. As private equity, venture capital, and asset management firms have become larger players between investors and the companies they are investing in, they have soaked up more money in commissions, fees, consulting dues, and performance incentives. Income from the finance industry used to account for roughly 3.5% of GDP until the early 70s, but today it accounts for over 10% according to data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That's 10% of the country's entire economy dedicated to paying bankers and financiers to move assets around between one another. The assets held by these institutions has also grown from less than 50% of GDP in 1980 to over 180% today. This means that a lot of these firms aren't too big to fail. They are just too big. Regulation should be here to deal with these misaligned incentives. But the last time the FTC ever broke up a company was right here in 1984 with AT&T. Since then, the only punishment for anti-competitive use of market power has been fines. And well, you know the thing about fines. And what's making the situation even worse for consumers is that corporations with the right connections are in a much better position to take advantage of or even influence policies that, in reality, are just bad ideas. Global economic uncertainty is at record highs, and while the stock market may have recovered, for now, real people are starting to feel the consequences of this little game. As layoffs are accelerated, hiring is frozen, prices are increasing, and interest rates are spiking. Now, I already know what you are thinking. There is nothing about these trade wars that hasn't been said already, and that's actually exactly the problem. For a variety of reasons, even highly respectable outlets and experts have been trying to find what the real meaning is behind the flip-flop trade war. Be it a secret plan to reduce interest rates before we refinance our debt, redefining the role of the US dollar as a global reserve, or just some 4D Uno negotiating tactic. These explanations are very entertaining and appealing to people who want to make sense of a situation that could really impact their personal financial situation. But if you want to look for deeper meaning where there is none, you should have majored in art history, not gone into journalism, economics, or business. Sometimes bad ideas are just bad ideas, and not acknowledging this has caused problems in politics and business well before we started putting tariffs on penguins. Now, I want to make it clear that it doesn't matter, or at the very least it shouldn't matter, if you personally love or hate this administration, the businesses we are going to talk about, or even your own boss. Bad ideas are just bad ideas, right? Well, of course not. But bad ideas are some of the best opportunities to get ahead, as long as you know how to use them. So, we may as well use this whole manufacturing crisis as a learning opportunity. Something that you should be personally aware of is that if you move up in the corporate ladder or start to have any kind of success in business, is that it's going to be much easier to find people who agree with anything you say. The trope of the yes man exists for a reason.
I see it all now. You're just a bunch of yes men. I was making the wrong moves and you were too gutless to tell me. Isn't that right?
Yes, sure.
Now, beyond the obvious problem of subordinates not wanting to clash with people that pay their salaries or business leaders not wanting to insult the government that regulates them, there are three other, far more subtle but equally effective ways that bad ideas get so much support. The first problem is that common sense is really hard to sell. If you have been paying attention to the news surrounding the trade wars, the Department of Government Efficiency, or even just regular run-of-the-mill corporate incompetence, you might have noticed that there is an almost endless supply of news and commentary claiming that even bizarre ideas actually kind of make sense. Now, some of this is just biased media reporting, nothing new there. But a lot of it is just people desperate to stand out in the marketplace of ideas. Our dumb little monkey brains love to see order and chaos. So the message that something that seems extremely scary is actually just part of a greater plan has been a great sales tactic for, well, all of human history. My friend Dr. Yuri Shasfort, who runs the channel Money and Macro, made a video last week breaking down the rationale behind resetting the global trade order. That video got a lot of attention because it looked like it was a defense of something that across the board has been pretty unpopular. Now that video was actually a breakdown of the economic thinking that the administration is probably working off of, explained from the perspective of a real academic economist. But it was also one of his most viewed videos ever, because in an ocean of news about how nothing makes sense anymore, even a hint of order is highly desirable. Now, Money and Macro's video was actually very good, so I will forgive him for being a little bit bold with his thumbnail. After all, that's what YouTube is. But it does demonstrate the point. Technology has made the marketplace of ideas open to anybody, but that's also made attention a valuable commodity. For better or worse, the best way to stand out from the noise is to stand out on ideas. Now, Yuri was using his powers for good, but there are plenty of other people willing to genuinely support bad ideas, for a price. In fact, one multi-billion dollar industry in particular has made it their entire operating model. Corporate consultants have been having their biggest years ever. During the pandemic, they couldn't grow fast enough because companies and even entire governments wanted smart-looking MBA grads to tell them how to set up work-from-home functions, adapt to new market conditions, and manage the crisis itself. In the UK, a report revealed that 2,300 management consultants from 73 different companies were contracted to work on the government's test and trace system, with £375 million spent on consultancy for this project alone. That meant for just this one project, the UK government had hired more consultants than people who worked in their own treasury department. We do exactly the same thing here back in the United States of political campaign donations. The only difference is our healthcare system is so disjointed that it's hard to get hard figures for the entire country. Right now, consulting firms are doing record business on integrating artificial intelligence into companies that can't figure it out for themselves. And of course, consulting firms are also billing thousands of hours to help companies deal with this trade war. In theory, consulting like this does have a role to play. Organizations are probably only going to need to react to a once-in-a-generation pandemic once in a generation. AI systems can be set up by a team that comes in, gets it done, and then does it for the next company without requiring full-time positions. But it rarely actually happens like this. The best way to secure lots of billable hours as a consultant is to find out what management already wants to do, and then create a report on why that is the only logical solution. McKinsey has published multiple articles on why working remotely is the best way to increase company efficiency, and they have also posted multiple articles about why returning to the office is essential for companies. So no matter what, the company can just point to the article that agrees with the decision they have already made. Now that's just consulting. Bad ideas can take you much further than that. With enough power and money, finding support for bad ideas is extremely easy. You might have already heard the story, but it's extremely funny and worth repeating as the perfect example of working backwards from a solution. President Trump has been a longtime advocate of protectionist policies to preserve domestic businesses and capabilities.
The fact is that you don't have free trade. We think of it as free trade, but you right now don't have free trade. And I think a lot of people are tired of watching other countries ripping off the United States.
He has been speaking out about this for a long time before he was president. And hot take alert, he kind of has a point. Globalization has been great for people with lots of money who could take advantage of new markets to sell their products into, global investment, and outsourced supply chains. But it wasn't as good for people who depended on their jobs that were getting outsourced. As someone who was born into wealth and stood to benefit directly from global markets and global investments into his businesses and properties, it could be argued that Trump's support for protections was purely altruistic. Now, maybe that's true, or maybe he just found a popular sounding message. You guys feel free to shout it out in the comments. Either way, identifying a problem is one thing. Working out a solution is the hard part, and the current architect of America's trade policy is an economist called Peter Navarro, who Trump first identified after his son-in-law found his book Death by China on Amazon. It's clearly an emotive title that vibes well with the idea that China is an enemy that must be crushed. Now, you are welcome to make up your own mind about the contents of the book. The documentary that is based off it is also available for free here on YouTube. So as always, I will leave a link to both of those down below. Now, even with the very heavy title, none of that by itself would be very interesting. Politicians rely on policy advisors all the time. But the only difference is, Navarro cited another economist called Ron Vara throughout his work who turned out to be completely made up. Ron Vara is just the letters in Navarro rearranged, so he wasn't even trying that hard. So yeah, some of the most impactful economic policies of the last century have been based on ideas supported by a man, supported by a book, supported by an apparition. It would be funny if so many people weren't going to lose their jobs over it. But it is a perfect example of how supporting contrarian ideas is a great way to get opportunities that level heads might not. Whether we like it or not, Peter Navarro and his imaginary friend are now some of the most influential economists in the world. There are only a handful of people in history that ever get to enact their policies on this scale, and he got that opportunity by supporting the right message. So yeah, next time senior management at your company has a questionable idea, make sure to get behind it wholeheartedly. It may hurt the business, but your resume will look great. And that's the third and most important reason why bad ideas get so much support. Bad ideas aren't allowed to just be bad ideas anymore. One thing that cheered me up last week while watching my life savings take a little rollercoaster ride was the tweets from people praising the stock market rally after telling their followers that the stock market didn't matter, after previously claiming that the stock market was the leading indication of a strong economy. Now, obviously, this hypocrisy was understandably criticized since most of this was just driven by partisanship, but it's also important people that can change their mind. The harder we make it for people to admit that they were wrong and reverse a harmful decision, the more likely they are to dig their heels in and overcommit to a bad idea. If you are managing people, this can be one of the most important skills to develop. You don't want people to take advantage of you. but you also don't want them to hide mistakes out of fear of reprisal. Now, government officials in the country's highest office should be held to a higher standard than subordinates, but there are a lot of factors that have made it extremely difficult for them to reverse bad decisions. Navarro, for example, has a PhD from Harvard, where his thesis was on the true motives behind corporate charities, something we have critiqued here on this very channel. But now, he is probably only going to be known as the guy that made up an expert on trade disputes. Expanding outwards, even on trade protections themselves, are probably going to get a bad rep from this. There is a lot to be said in support of protecting local industries and making sure that average American workers aren't forced to make sacrifices just so multinational corporations remain competitive. However, any new protectionist proposals in the future are going to be challenged by people pointing out that it's just another tariff war. So why would we want to do that again? Smart people have bad ideas all the time. It doesn't mean that they are automatically wrong about everything. And even if the solution to a problem is bad, it doesn't mean the problem no longer exists. But increasingly polarizing news and shortened attention spans means that this is probably going to happen more and more. So, how do you take advantage of this? Well, if you're going to support an idea in your own career, make sure you get behind it without being the face of it. Express support to your bosses, but do it quietly so you'll get all the rewards of being on board, but can't be used as a scapegoat when it inevitably all comes crashing down. I really don't want to have to keep uncovering everything coming out of Washington, and I want to emphasize that we called out the last administration too. But on a channel that's made for highlighting dumb ideas in business, finance, and economics, it's hard to make a video about much else when these actions make everything irrelevant by comparison.